you need to stand behind the microphone, Steve. So, right. So, most of you have probably seen Steve. I'm sure that we all recognise him because he's the proud possessor of the best beard in the church by a long measure. But I'm sure that not everyone knows him. So, Steve, can you introduce yourself?
Yeah, sorry. Kate's just come back from the toilet, so I'm just going to
swap babies. Yeah.
Sorry. I'm Steve. I work as a freelance graphic designer and web designer. How much detail do you want me to go into?
Oh, I don't know. Got a family, obviously. Just tell us a bit more about, you know, how long have you been here and so on. You know?
I was part of the original Cosmestan congregation that merged with Emmanuel before Eden was formed. I'm married to Kate, with the sound of the baby too. And we got three little kids. Noah, he's at the back on some colouring, I think, is five. Sylvie, who's just turned three this week. And Gwen, who just arrived a couple of months ago.
Okay. So you're a freelance graphic designer.
Yeah.
Any interesting clients that you think the church might be interested in?
Most of the work I do, or a lot of the work I do, is for just sort of small local businesses and things, different projects that people are doing. There is one that's a bit more interesting, but I'm not sure I should say in like a church context, but I did some work for Mystic Meg recently.
Right.
Which is, yeah, a bit random. So that's like most of the commercial work that I do. But then the vast majority of the time I spend working for a charity called Bible Educational Services.
Okay. Which is what? Tell us a bit about Bible Educational Services.
Okay. Basically, Bible Educational Services is a charity that's concerned with teaching young people the Word of God, basically. Their key verse, which they kind of hold on to as like their mission statement, is I think it's Psalm 78 verse 4. Is that right? it's we will tell the next generation the praiseworthy deeds of the Lord and the wonders he has done, I think.
So how do they do that? How do they tell the next generation?
Okay, well basically what they've done is they've published a range of Bible lessons for kids. Basically, it's quite an extensive course. It's split into five age levels. The courses are sent out or produced monthly. Each lesson, and then each lesson is split into four stories. Then, and then there's a three-year syllabus per age level. So across the five age levels, there's a child can start doing these lessons when they're like age three or four and do one every week until I think pretty much 18, if my maths is right, something like that. So it's quite an extensive course. And these Bible lesson things, they're supposed to be like fun, interactive, like all different puzzles and colouring and things like that in them. So that's basically what they do at the moment. But should I go into the history a bit? Because I'll kind of give those a little bit.
Yeah, tell us a bit about where it started, yeah.
Okay. It started, actually it started back in the 50s with my grandfather, which a lot of people will probably know, especially if you went to Emmanuel, Bert and Wendy Gray. They moved over to the Republic of Ireland in the 50s. They wanted to serve God, and I think the kind of burden, I suppose, that was laid on them was that it's a very rural place. A lot of kids live on farms. And it's difficult for them to get to a church because it's so far to go on a Sunday morning. So they had the idea of starting what they called a postal Bible school, a postal Sunday school it was called at the time, and would post out a little Bible lesson every month to this child on a farm somewhere in rural Ireland, and the child would fill out the lesson, send it back, and they would mark it and give them feedback. So I think in 1958 it started with a single student. It grew from there and they got more and more students, like through the 60s and 70s then, and then more and more people heard about it, and then more and more postal Bible schools started popping up all around the UK. These all ran independently of each other. So basically it was just someone would have that passion, desire to want to try and reach children in their area, so would take these lessons and send them out to children in their area, mark them, give the kids feedback, and then a lot of them would start organising sort of holiday camps in the summer or weekends away. They would save up their scores from the lessons over a year, and they would do prize giving nights when they'd get all the kids together and give them prizes based on it all. And then I think it was the early 80s then was when these Bible lessons had been going for a while. They kind of identified that they needed to be regularly edited and updated. So that's when Bible Educational Services was started as kind of like a publisher, and they would supply the lessons to all these independent postal Bible schools spread all around the UK. So that's where it came from.
So around the UK, right? Did it stay in the UK? Where is it now? What kind of... where are people doing these lessons now?
Okay, it's... I think in the UK, there's still about a dozen or so postal Bible schools, and I think there's probably about 10,000 or so students subscribe to those postal Bible schools. I think towards the end of the 80s and the 90s, with the fall of the Berlin Wall and collapse of communism in Eastern Europe and things, suddenly, I'm not sure exactly how it all happened, but there was a massive... demand for the lessons across Eastern Europe, and been trying to teach people about God in those areas. So it really grew in Romania, Poland, all those sort of countries through the 80s and 90s. And then into the noughties then, it went pretty global, started spreading all around Africa, some South America, and I think it's pretty much all around the world at the moment. Last year, enough material was printed for 3 million kids, I think, to be able to do the lessons. I'm not sure they were all used, but still quite a lot.
So I turn up on a Sunday morning and I have a congregation of 60 or something, and I love every one of you. Steve sits in his office and has a congregation of 3 million. Well, there's more than just you doing the lessons, isn't there? But but you get the idea. It's an incredible worldwide work. That's kind of you think we're just an ordinary little suburban church, and we've got people doing remarkable stuff in amongst us. What about the future? Internet age? Are you thinking about that?
Yeah, we've actually been really blessed, I suppose. There's a guy that worked through the course when he was younger, a Russian guy, and he created his own app, which he sold to Skype for a lot of money, and then Skype got bought out by Microsoft, and I think again he got a lot of money for that. So he's used all that money now to employ a team of developers who are turning this whole course into an app. He's been working on that for quite a few years now, and it just launched. It was a soft launch, but it launched earlier this year. If it's kind of aimed at, I think sort of 7 to 9 at the moment, there is plans to expand it, and you put in your age, and it will kind of tailor the app to your age group and things. But what we're actually after for at the moment is for people to download it and to give us feedback on it. What's launched at the moment, it's kind of a soft launch, so we're not massively promoting it. So we want people to have a go at it, give us feedback, and that'll allow us to develop it further, improve it. So if you've got a smartphone, either iOS or Android, just search for Sun School. That's SUNSCOOL. So school without the H in. It makes it cool. So search for that. And also with Bible Educational Services, all those lessons that we do, they're all online. And as well as the 3 million that we've printed for people to use, there's a lot of people around the world that download them for free as well through our website. And we're not really able to gauge exactly how many people do that, but I don't know, it would probably work within the sort of Sunday school setup here if you want another resource to use, or if you just want to check out a little bit more about what we do. And that website is besweb.com.
Okay. I think we'll try and send the links out after for anyone who's interested in looking at it. What about how can we support BES preview, I guess? And
It's everything we do is free for the end user. Just for the postal Bible schools and things, the only thing they usually charge for is the cost of the stamps. Or the child has to pay for a stamp to send it back to the postal Bible school that they're subscribed to. So there is obviously like a financial need there. There is a few trusts that support our work, but then there's a few individuals as well that do. So obviously there's financial. But the biggest thing is prayer, I think. The work obviously is massive. And especially with the development of the app now, we are looking for people sort of to give feedback on that. And then as the app grows, there's, like I said, with the number of lessons that we got, try and work out quickly off the top of my head, but something like 800 lessons, I think, and we want to put every single one of those into the app. So there's a huge amount of work in doing that. And so we kind of like need a team of volunteers to be able to do that. But then, I didn't really go into this earlier, but obviously as it's gone around the world, it's been translated into loads of languages. So it's in about 30 or 40 different languages at the moment. And again, because it's already been translated in the paper version, we've got the translation there to be able to translate the app as well. So there's a huge amount of like data entry and things for that. So we're looking for teams of volunteers to be able to help us out with that, get involved. And it's finding, the struggle all the time with it, maybe even more than financial, is finding enough people to be able to sort of give their time to help with it. Because like I said, it is faith-based. The operating costs are really low because the majority of the people are volunteers. There's only about two or three that are actually paid. I'm one of them. but the amount I'm paid is less than half what I like charge my time for commercially. So we all try and work as cheaply as possible, I suppose, because we believe in what we're doing. Prayer, financial a little bit, but people, and pray for those people as well to be able to come forward.
Brilliant, thanks, Steve. That's okay. A really good story. There you go. Congregation of 3 million. What would you give for that one, there, Joe? Right. The older group, is it? Hang on. Rock Boulders. I've forgotten what they're called now. You know who you are. You can, Right, so back in the days of the First World War, then for people who were fighting on the front line, then communication was sometimes a little bit difficult. You know, telephones didn't work terribly well. Telegraph wires were always sort of being hit by shells and so on. So one of the ways in which messages were conveyed from the front line back to HQ and so on was through runners, you know, and so somebody would get a message from the front line and they'd run as far as they could, and when they were exhausted they'd pass it on to somebody else who'd run and so on, and the message would get relayed back. And unfortunately, of course, when you're choosing someone to do your running for you, then the chances are you choose someone who's pretty fit rather than someone who's particularly clever. And as a result, sometimes the messages didn't always get completely understood by the runners, and they get a little bit garbage. So the Canadian Expeditionary Forces some of the people involved with that wrote their memoirs back in 1918 about sort of how some of this running mechanism worked. And there was one particular message which the person at the front line had sent the message am held up by barbed wire, entanglements, sorry, line break in the wrong place. I'm held up by barbed wire entanglements. Send reinforcements to my right. And of course the message gets sort of passed on and passed on. And at the end of it, instead of being I'm held up by barbed wire entanglements, send reinforcements to my right, it's the message had turned into, after going through a whole bunch of not very clever runners, was I'm surrounded by wild Italians, lend me three and fourpence until tonight. And the irony about that story about an inaccurate message is this. Nobody actually knows whether the story itself is true either. You know, it kind of like goes around in a circle, doesn't it? How accurate is the story about an inaccurate message? And the issue is this. Communications naturally degrade. And the question is this also true of the Bible? Because the Bible is an old book. And has it changed over time? I mean, Steve's talk, the reason I asked Steve to tell us about Bible education services today was because it fits so well with my subject this morning. The Bible that he's teaching, you know, they've got the Bible educational services has got the mission to tell the next generation about. What is that Bible that we're passing on? What if the stories that Steve is putting into the lessons when he's doing his work as a graphic designer was actually all made up by medieval monks and fabricated somewhere in the Middle Ages? And maybe what we have got in the Bible isn't true, and some of the more fanciful stories are right, and Jesus actually did run off with Mary Magdalene and start a family in France, and that someone's doctored the Bible since to take out those stories. If the Bible's really ancient, then has it become corrupted beyond recognition? And so, you know, we've got this series that we're working our way through about acknowledging in our hearts that Jesus Christ is Lord, which is the first strand. And the verse carries on to be ready to give an answer, the second strand, for the hope that we have. And we're back in that second strand, being ready to give an answer. Because a lot of people will say to you, how do you know the Bible's accurate? Wasn't it kind of changed by the popes in the Reformation? Is it really what was originally written? So I'm going to try and answer the question where the Bible came from. I can't answer the question, which is equally important, is it true? Otherwise we'll never finish, right? But let's ask the question where it came from. And then you can kind of think about if it's true, if you're interested, as a bit of homework. But let's begin by asking why it matters, right? Why is the Bible so important? Well, let's go back to, I mentioned the Reformation once already, and one of the doctrines that Martin Luther taught in the Reformation was this. You may or may not have heard of it. Sola Scriptura. The Bible only. That's what that means. And what Luther said was this. He said, the Bible of the Old and New Testaments is the only divinely inspired book and the only source of divinely revealed knowledge. Scripture alone is the formal principle of the faith and the final authority for all matters of faith and morals because of its inspiration, authority, clarity, efficacy, and sufficiency. Great words, right? And this is a Baptist church. Emmanuel Fellowship had its roots in the Brethren. Both the Baptist and the Brethren tradition hold to that teaching of Luther. Sola Scriptura. That everything that we need for matters of faith and doctrine can be found in the Bible. And so, everything that we teach here in Eden Church is based on the Bible. If I say something that's based on my own personal views on politics or ethics or morality, well, first of all, I'll try not to. If I do, then hopefully I'll signpost it to you and say, this is just what I think, not what the Bible says. But you've got the right to test everything that I say, or everything that Jay says, or anyone else who's preaching here on a Sunday morning. You've got the right to test it against Scripture. And if it doesn't hold good, then you can throw it back at us and say, you're wrong. It's not in the Bible. So we don't base what we say on our own personal views, on the views of Baptist tradition, on the works of J.N. Darby, if you come from the Brethren tradition, or from any other tradition that you might have come from, we base it on the Bible. The Bible is the core of what we say and what we do, because we believe it's inspired by God. Now, that does give me a bit of a problem, because today's talk is not actually based on the Bible. So, hey, but it's a bit hard to use the Bible to talk about where the Bible came from. So I'd be in an awful circle if I tried to do that. But in the main, everything that we say and do is based on the Bible. Because we believe the Bible's inspired. And what do we mean when we say that the Bible is inspired? Well, what we mean is that when the biblical writers wrote the original text of the Bible, that God guided them, that God protected them from error, and that as a result of God guiding them and protecting them from error, the teachings of the Bible are, right, and use the words, error-free and authoritative. So we believe that the Bible is free of error, and we believe it has authority. It doesn't mean when we say the Bible was inspired by God that God dictated every word, because there are parts of the Bible where the writer tells us, and God told me this directly, and the implication is that the rest of it is not dictated by God, but it means that God guided the words. If God had dictated every word, then all the books would have sounded the same. They would have had God's way of speaking, but they haven't. Every book has got the character of its own author. When we say the Bible is the inspired word of God, it doesn't mean to say the Bible is an adequate and complete source of information on all subjects. I don't turn to the Bible if I want to know about chemistry. I don't turn to the Bible if I want to know about astronomy or geography. In those cases, the Bible relies on the background information that its authors knew. But what the Bible does claim for itself is this, and this is where I will quote the Bible this morning. Paul, writing in Timothy, said this, that all scripture is breathed out by God, and it's profitable. And here's the things that we can use the Bible for. It's profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, and for training in righteousness, so that the messenger of God may be competent and equipped for every good work. And that's what we can use the Bible for those things. And for those things, sola scriptura, the Bible is sufficient. We don't need anything else. Now, again, by way of background, that doesn't mean, as some people who like to mock fundamentalists like me, because I'm quite proud to call myself an evangelical fundamentalist, right? It doesn't mean, as mockers would say, that every word in the Bible is literally true. Because much of the Bible, let's be careful about that, undoubtedly parts of the Bible are figurative. So, for example, God speaking to Job, in the book of Job, says that he has set doors and bars to keep the sea in its place. Now, that doesn't mean that God has actually got some wooden doors with bars across them to keep the sea in its place. You know, God's using the figure of speech. And so we have to be very careful when we look at the Bible that we don't take things in the wrong way. And that we don't kind of interpret it in our own favourite way, and we say, well, I don't like that one, so I'll make it a figure of speech, and I like that one, so I won't make it a figure of speech. We've got to look at it carefully and try and understand the way in which it was originally meant to be read. But it does mean that because we believe the Bible is authoritative, that we're not free to reinterpret it in our own way. We have to find out, stick to its original meaning. Someone said that we don't make up our religion, we find it out. We go looking in the Bible to find out what our religion is, rather than put into the Bible what we would like our religion to be. And it means that we're not free to embellish our religion with additional legends, that the cross was made of dogwood, perhaps, or to change the literary style of the Bible. The Bible was written in the plain language of everyday folk. And much as I might love sort of beautiful historic language, it's actually misrepresenting the Bible to translate it and use it in a way which is not readily understood by ordinary people. It's not supposed to be a nice story. It's supposed to be accurate. But that's a bit of background about why it matters where the Bible came from. But let's think a bit about who wrote it. Now, we've got 66 books. 39 in the Old Testament, 27 in the New Testament, right? We all know that, don't we? Now, it might surprise you to know that that's not the case for Bibles in all countries, but that's another matter we'll come to in a minute. But here in Britain, in Protestant churches, we have 66 books, 39 in the Old Testament and 27 in the New. And those books were written by many authors spread out over about 1,500 years or so. And so, for example, Moses wrote the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Solomon, King Solomon, he wrote several of the wisdom books. David wrote many of the Psalms. The books of prophecy are largely written by the person whose name they bear. There are a number of Old Testament historical books that we don't know exactly who wrote, but the New Testament authorship is much clearer. The three Gospels, and the first three Gospels, Matthew, Luke, and John, were written by eyewitnesses. People who, and we'll come to how we know that in a moment, but three of those Gospels were written by eyewitnesses, people who actually saw Jesus and watched the miracles that he did. One Gospel, Mark, wasn't written by an eyewitness, but was written by someone who probably saw some of the things for himself, but was believed to have been compiled in close association with Peter, who was the eyewitness. And so he was Peter's sort of storyteller, if you like. The epistles, the letters, were largely written by the apostles, conveniently, because they rhyme. And in all cases, the claimed authors were very, very close to the action. And that's important, because eyewitness evidence is as strong as it gets. If I want to know sort of what happened during the parade in the Penarth Festival last summer, the best place to go and find out is to talk to someone who was actually in the parade in the Penarth Festival. Not to someone who knew someone who was friends with someone whose window cleaner went to the festival, right? And it's important that the Bible claims to have been written by people who witnessed the events that they saw. They're not claiming to have written legends. They're saying, this is what I saw. And similarly, when we look at the epistles, you know, the letters, then again, the apostles, Apostle Paul and Peter and James and so on, they knew the exact situation in the early church that they were writing to when they were writing their letters. So they knew exactly what to write. They knew exactly what the problems were. They're not basing this on legend, on hearsay, on, well, I've heard 500 years later that people were doing this in Ephesus. No, Paul's writing to an Ephesian church where he knows the individuals and knows their frailties and know the mistakes they make. And they were all, and as a result of that, there was no time for new doctrines to be embellished and added over generations before they were written down. So we can be confident that the doctrines that we read in the New Testament were actually the doctrines that that Jesus taught, if the authors were actually the people who they claimed to be. But that in itself gives us a problem. I'm old enough to remember just about the news in 1983. Well, I was quite old in 1983, so I can more than just about remember it. But back in 1983, then there was an amazing discovery made in Germany. Stern, a newspaper in Germany, was offered for sale what somebody had discovered, 60 volumes, which were appeared to be Hitler's diaries. And they gave a blow-by-blow account of Nazi Germany and the record of what had gone on in the war. An amazing discovery. Historians were terribly excited. In Britain, the publication rights were bought by the Sunday Times, and on the 24th of April back in 1983, then the Sunday Times published the first episode of the Hitler Diaries. And the world was talking of nothing else. Until, unfortunately, in a huge media storm, it was revealed a few days later that the diaries were fraudulent. They were carefully put together by a German crook who had pocketed the cash and disappeared. They tracked him down eventually, and he did his time for it. So it's quite easy to fool people you know, about, you know, you say, you write something and you sign it Adolf at the bottom and everybody thinks, well, this was written by Hitler. But, you know, but it was just actually somebody else who put his name up. So is the Bible a forgery? Could it have been written generations later by people who claimed to be Paul and Matthew and Mark and all these people? Were the cited authors the real authors? Well, to understand that, I think we need to look separately at the different parts of the Bible. If we look at the New Testament, firstly, the books have got the hallmarks of an eyewitness account. Well, first of all, they're written in the correct language. They're written not just in the correct language, they're written in the correct dialect that is corroborated by other ancient records. They were clearly written by people who knew exactly how people spoke in ancient Galilee, everyday Greek of the time. Recent research has been done, sort of looking, interestingly, statistically, looking at the incidence of names in different parts of the ancient Near East. And again, you find that the incidence of names matches up very closely what you find in the New Testament from what other historical records say. And where you get common names, then the Bible sort of offers clarifications. You have Judas Iscariot, for example. It's a clarified name because Judas was an extremely common name in that particular area of the world at that time, whereas other names were less common and didn't need clarification. Something that you couldn't possibly have known unless you were there. Do you know what the most popular names are in Birmingham at the moment? Because I don't. And it's easy for us because we've got the internet to help us to do the research. But other things, the place names were right. The geographical descriptions were right. For example, you know, one of the Gospels mentions the five porticos of the Pool of Bethesda. And that was uncovered recently in an archaeological dig. And sure enough, there were five porticos around the pool. Little incidental details which show that the books were written by people who were familiar with the geography and culture of the time. But there's other internal evidence. The book of Acts stops abruptly at the date that it was written. And it doesn't make any reference to important things that happened afterwards, like the martyrdom of many of the apostles in AD 67, or the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. And given that Jesus had prophesied that that Jerusalem would be destroyed, and given that the martyrdom of the apostles had been prophesied as well, then it's unthinkable that the author of Acts would not have put in these bits of corroborating evidence at the end of his story if it weren't for the fact that he'd written this book before they happened. And we also find that other ancient writings from people like the Church Fathers who quote almost all of the New Testament books. Clement, for example, writes to the Corinthian church and reminds them of the letters that Paul had written to them earlier. And Ignatius and Polycarp and Papias, they quote from 25 out of 27 of the New Testament books. And they all lived in the first and the second century. Justin Martyr, another person, quotes from 13 books. And Irenaeus, another one of the church fathers, quotes from 26 out of the 27 books in the New Testament. So all of these books were being quoted by different people around the world centuries ago. So if they were forged or doctored or manipulated later on in the Middle Ages, then somebody did a pretty good job of leaving a trail of other forged and manipulated documents all over the place. So we can actually be very confident the New Testament was written at the claimed time by the claimed authors. But the Old Testament is interesting as well. In 1947, just after the Second World War, there was a Bedouin boy who was searching for a lost goat near the Dead Sea. And he tossed a stone to see whether he could startle the goat and make it run and appear from behind a rock or something. And when the stone landed, he heard the sound of something breaking. So he went to investigate, climbed up into a cave where the stone had landed, and found that the cave was full of jars which had leather scrolls wrapped in linen inside them. And a bit of carbon dating later, and they discovered that the scrolls had been placed there in AD 68. They'd been there for nearly 2,000 years. And many of the manuscripts were already ancient at the time they were written there. So there's a copy of the book of Isaiah, which was written there, which was already 200 years old at the time it was placed in the cave. And that's interesting, because in the 19th century, a lot of critics had said that Isaiah was obviously written after the New Testament, because so many of the prophecies that it contained were so accurate about Jesus. It couldn't possibly have been written before. And you have this copy of Isaiah turned up that was older than Jesus. Very unhelpful for the critics. And the scrolls contain much of the Old Testament. Not all of it, but fragments of almost every book in the Old Testament. And they also contain quotes that appear to be from the New Testament. But they're very, very short quotes as well. So some people would argue, well, they were just independent writings. But there are about a dozen quotes in the Dead Sea Scrolls that appear to be fragments of the New Testament. So, it's very difficult to get evidence of authorship of the Old Testament so many thousands of years after it was written. But it's clear that the Old Testament is ancient enough to have been written by the people who claim to write it. But you know, the books might be old. The question is, have they been tampered with over time? Have the reinforcements turned into 3 and 4 pence, to go back to our story about the First World War? So that was one of the things that people were most interested in when the Dead Sea Scrolls emerged, because the copy of Isaiah in the Dead Sea Scrolls was about 1,000 years older than any other existing copy of the book of Isaiah. And so people were interested to find out, well, how much had Isaiah changed over the 1,000 years that were in between? Because obviously it had been copied many times, and there was plenty of opportunity for reinforcements to turn into 3 and 4 pence. And the clear implication was this, right? If Isaiah had changed a lot in the 1,000 years that we could measure it, then Isaiah was actually written maybe 800 years or so before the Dead Sea Scrolls copy. So perhaps that, if Isaiah had stayed consistent for the 1,000 years we could measure, then it was probably pretty consistent for the previous 800 years. If it had changed a lot, then that suggested that we don't actually have a clue what Isaiah originally wrote. So the scholars sat down and started having a look to see how much had changed. And the accuracy is astonishing. 95% of the text is identical. So if we just take the most famous chapter of Isaiah, Isaiah chapter 53, the story of the suffering servant. There's 166 Hebrew words in Isaiah chapter 53. And in those 166 words, in 1,000 years, then 17 letters had changed. Of those 17 letters, 10 of them were spelling differences, so they weren't really changes at all. And 4 of them were minor stylistic changes to pronouns. So the only substantive change in that whole chapter was one additional word that doesn't change the meaning. And so the conclusion is that what people had often taught them, the Masoretic scholars who had a tradition of trying to very reliably copy documents from one generation to the next, here was incontrovertible evidence that they did a really thorough job. So we can be very confident that the Old Testament has been accurately preserved from what was originally written. But what about the New Testament with a very different background? Well, back in Jesus' day, then there were 2 kinds of medium that you'd write stuff on. If something was important, you'd use parchment. But parchment was expensive. It was made from the skin of a dead animal, so you had to pay a lot for it. If it was something that was fairly cheap, you weren't sure how important it was, then you'd write it on papyrus, which is kind of made out of reeds. But the trouble with papyrus is it was a bit fragile. And there's no doubt that the original sort of copies of the New Testament would have been written on papyrus. And then just as they wore out, then they'd have taken copies of the copies of the copies and so on. And as a result of that, then typically we tend to not have historically copies of ancient documents until hundreds of years later, once they becomes very well established, they were important enough to put them on an expensive medium like parchment rather than a cheap medium like papyrus. And as a result, things like, for example, Caesar's writings, then the earliest copies we've got of Caesar's writings come from AD 900, and we've got about 10 copies that date from there. Plato, AD 900 as well, a gap of about 1,200 years from when he wrote it down. Homer's Iliad is the best documented ancient piece of writing, and there's about a gap of about 500 years before we get a good high-quality copy, which is still readable today. And there's about 600 copies of that. So the best documented ancient writing, apart from the Bible, 600 copies after a gap of 500 years. The New Testament instead of 643, the New Testament has got 24,000 copies of complete manuscripts and fragments and partial copies of it in multiple languages from many locations all around the Near East. And the earliest fragment dates to 125 AD, which is a gap of about 25 years from when the book was originally written, which shows a part of John's Gospel. And of course, the New Testament is heavily corroborated by other writings. So we know that the New Testament was actually written at the time it was claimed to be written. We know it was written by eyewitnesses, and we know that it hasn't changed. And as I say, for homework is to find out whether, if you're interested, find out whether actually what they wrote was true or not. But at least we know that it was claimed to be true, written by people who were actually there with incredibly good evidence. But what are the books of the Bible? Because some people claim that the Bible that we've got are just the ones that suit us. And that actually other Gospels, like the Gospel of Thomas is the one that's often cited, are actually more accurate. And this is where I'll come back to different Bibles having different numbers of books. Becky's not here this morning, but if she were, I'm sure she'd be able to tell you that many of the East African churches have a Bible with 81 books in it, not 67 like we have. I've got a couple of Bibles at home which have got an extra section in between the Old and the New Testament called the Apocrypha, which covers the intertestamental period between the Old and the New Testament. And other controversy, Martin Luther believed that Jude, James, Hebrews and Revelation were lesser books and he wanted them removed from the Bible, although he was unsuccessful in that argument. But we, all of us, whether we're East African or Martin Luther or not, have the Gospels and the Epistles and the Pentateuch and the Prophets and the Wisdom books and the historical books. So most of it we've got. So, where does it come from? Well, the Old Testament is perhaps the easiest to deal with. The Old Testament, that we have is the same Old Testament that the Jews have. It's come from ancient Hebrew texts called the Masoretic texts. The Jews, in their Bible, they have some of it in a slightly different order, and some things are the book divisions are a bit different, like Jeremiah and Lamentations are one book if you're a Jew, and they're two books for us as Christians. So the order's a little bit different, and the book divisions are different, but we've got exactly the same book as the Jews have had. And the lists of books which are in the Old Testament have been written down by dozens of people going back over thousands of years. And we can be very confident that we know exactly, for example, what books Jesus had in his Bible. The New Testament is perhaps a little more complex. What happened amongst the early Christians was that books which were known to be written by reliable people were distributed amongst the early Christians and were often quoted by the early church fathers. And they became established by custom and by practice. And that kind of position happened for about 200 years until there were some arguments where people started trying to insert additional books which had not been widely accepted and these additional books taught different things from the 27 books that were largely accepted. And so, as a result, the canon, as we call it, the canon of Scripture, became fixed in about the 2nd century, and it was formally agreed in the church council in Hippo in 397. But that was just a recognition of what had already been accepted. So Origen and Eusebius, two ancient church fathers, had listed all of the books in the New Testament much earlier than that. And the aim was to guard against heresy. And at the time of the Council of Hippo, there was a careful investigation into every book where they sought to establish authorship. And they made sure that every book in our Bible, based on the evidence they had at the time, which was very close to when Jesus was alive, was written under apostolic authority. That was the first thing. And they made sure that that every book in the Bible was consistent with the others and with the accepted sort of Christian faith, and they also looked to make sure that every book that they considered for inclusion was accepted by pretty much the whole church, and had been, to the best of their knowledge, for the whole of the time since it had first been written. So those are the criteria that were used for inclusion. Apostolic authority, doctrine, and broad acceptance. And so the list was published, and that's the list that we have now. And it's important for us to understand this. The books that we have in the Bible are not authoritative because they're in the Bible. They're in the Bible because those books are authoritative. And there's a big difference between the two. Now, I could go on for ages, but I'm not going to, because otherwise you'll hate me and you'll get bored. But this is an important subject for us as Christians, because we base everything that we say on the Bible. And if we can't trust it, and if it hasn't got historical authenticity, then we're basing our faith on something which is made out of quicksand. And it's important for us to be confident. It's important for us to be able to answer people, because it is often claimed, well, the Bible was doctored. The Bible has been manipulated. The Catholic Church changed all the doctrines to make it suit what they wanted to teach. And these things are not true. And there is very good historical evidence to demonstrate they're not true. But it's very easy for someone to make these assertions, whether it's in an internet chat room here or just in a conversation down the pub there. And people believe it. And it's up to us to counter that. We can be very confident that the Bible was written by people who lived and saw what Jesus did. And they intended it as a record of what happened. I can suggest a couple of books for you if you want to go and read more. A couple of books I've enjoyed. There's one called Why Trust the Bible by a lady called Amy Orr Ewing. Very good read. There are lots of scholarly books that you could go and read if you want to, but if you want something which is kind of accessible to the likes of you and me, then that's a good one. Another one which deals only with the New Testament is called The Case for Christ by Lee Strobel. And if you're interested, go and read them. I can make my notes, these brief notes, available if anyone's interested as well, so let me know and I can pass them on. But just to conclude, we can be confident that the New Testament was written by eyewitnesses of Jesus. We can be confident the Old Testament dates back to the claimed period of authorship. We can be confident that the entire Bible in its original language is an accurate reflection of what was originally written. We can be confident that the manuscript evidence in support of the Bible is extraordinarily abundant and ancient, and that we have the correct books in our Bible, in our canon, and any differences aren't theologically important. And that, as a result, we're not surrounded by wild Italians, and we have no need of three and fourpence until tonight.